So what I would like to talk, or try to talk about a little bit tonight, is about priorities and perspectives, which I think is a very important topic in for Buddhist practice, for mindfulness practice. And it's on my mind because it's kind of what I talked about the retreat I was teaching the last 10 days. I talked about it on Saturday. So it's still kind of alive for me. And the retreat itself is still very much alive for me. I ended yesterday at noon, and I'm still... I flew back, I was in New Mexico, a beautiful retreat center in New Mexico, outside of Santa Fe, and I flew back last night, and still kind of, part of me is still in Santa Fe. And I'm a little bit tired tonight from all that work. But I was very strong, very deeply moved by the retreat, by the intensity of people's engagement with the practice and the significance that it had in their lives. For some reason, this particular retreat had more... I taught it with another teacher, Eric Kolvig, and he used the word wounded, more wounded people than ever, than most retreats. And maybe because of that, it was maybe more significant for that particular group than ever before. And people really engaged very honestly with their life and with their issues and their pain. One woman had a dream late in the retreat where all these people paraded in front of her, kind of like a costume ball. All these people were in costumes and they were all... But everybody was carrying a gift. And the gift was wrapped in pain. I thought that was a pretty powerful image from a dream. The gift was wrapped in pain. And it's often the case that there's gifts inside our pain. And if we can look at it and be willing to feel it and see it and be honest about it, then it's really a wonderful thing. It can be. I discovered recently this wonderful... I like words a lot, and I discovered that the word admit has various meanings. And if you, one is to acknowledge, to confess, you know, to admit something. But it also means to enter or to allow in, to admit in or to enter in. And in some ways, the two meanings go very closely together. To admit something, to acknowledge something, allows a certain kind of entrance, a certain kind of allowing things into our life that wouldn't be allowed. Certain entrances wouldn't be stepped into if we didn't admit what was really going on with us, if we weren't really ruthlessly honest. And part of the function of retreats is for people to be very honest with themselves in a way that the people are seldom honest with themselves outside. And one of the things I found, however, on the retreat, and is, I mean, I find this all the time with all of us, is the degree in which we will measure and judge our practice, our mindfulness practice. And maybe we're kind of just don't do it so much in daily practice, but in retreats it can be epidemic. how am I doing? Am I doing well enough? You know, you sit down to meditate and you have three breaths, and then you wonder, am I doing it yet? Have I gotten it? Am I far enough? Three breaths, you know, give yourself a break. And the constant kind of checking out and measuring and comparing to other people how they're doing or imagine they're doing. And often the criteria that people use for how well their practice is going, for the measurement of a spiritual practice, often is kind of not really that which is of consequence, that which is consequential. People often measure the success of their practice, for example, how concentrated they get, or how calm they get, or how blissful they get, or they have a certain state of mind or state of being, or some certain criteria of like, well, can I really stay with 24 breaths at a time? You know, no, I managed to get three, and then my mind spaced out for the next 240, and then you come back for another two, And so that's going to be very discouraging because if people have this idea, well, what you're supposed to do is, you know, you're supposed to stay with your breathing or stay in the present moment and acknowledge. And people will get and measure themselves as failures in their practice. And I don't feel, in the years that I've practiced, in the years that I've taught, I don't think that that which is most consequential is the state of calm or the state of peace or joy or the state of concentration that... we enter into in our practice. We try to engage ourselves as fully as we can with the present moment, to be as aware and attentive and honest about what's happening in the moment as we can. But That's not my, the success in doing that might not be what's most consequential in our practice. What's most consequential might not be happening in the moment, or might not be happening on the surface of the moment so you can see it. You know, we kind of take this moment to be, you know, this is where it's at, and this is, it better be here. We manage to get ourselves in the present moment. That's what the practice is, right? And then we judge it. Rather, there's undercurrents within us, subterranean kind of caverns in which our spiritual life is moving and developing and changing, which sometimes aren't very clear how that, what's happening. But as we engage ourselves with the honesty, with looking carefully, with coming into the present moment the best we can, it's kind of like it's developing all kinds of qualities within us that might not be clear in the moment that you're either calm or agitated. One of them is very powerful. One way to look at that is look at the power of intentions, the power of the values which we put ourselves behind and kind of engage ourselves into. To have the intention to be loving, the intention to be open-hearted. You might not have any success in the moment in being kind, but that intention is like planting a seed within you, which then will, because each time in the future you kind of try to be kind or try to be open-hearted or try to be in the present moment, you kind of water that seed. And in the moment you might not succeed, but you might in the future, somehow that will blossom into something really wonderful. So what I often see on longer retreats, like 10-day retreats and longer, is that the real consequence, what's real, a real consequence for people on the retreat, is often not clear when the retreat is over or in the middle of the retreat, but often becomes clear sometimes months later what the real meaning and the consequence of the retreat is. And I like the word consequence, what's consequential, because the word karma in Buddhism has to do with consequences. And consequences, in Buddhist point of view, arises from our intentions, not from the state we manage to reach. And so intentions have consequence. And if we can get behind our intention, understand our intention, explore our intention, and then kind of get behind it in our practice, that's watering the seeds of this wonderful garden within us, which in its own way will blossom. You know, the classic story, if you plant corn, and you go out in the cornfield and pull in the corn plant to see how they're growing, you know, it's not going to happen. And our own spiritual life is that way too. If you go constantly measuring and seeing how you're doing, you know, every day or every meditation period, you might actually be pulling the plant out of the ground and not letting it be. So I told a story Saturday evening at the beginning of the talk that I think I've told here before. But it felt very much kind of the spirit of priorities and intentions, and also the fact that there was 23 people who had been sitting for 10 days together as a group. And the story goes that some years ago there was a Special Olympics, I think up in Seattle. And there were these kids. I think, as I remember the story, they all had Down syndrome. And they were in a foot race. And so they were at the starting line, and on your mark, get set, go, and they took off for the finish line. And one of them pretty quickly tripped and fell. Whereupon all the other kids stopped, turned around and went back, helped the one that fell up, and then they walked hand in hand to the finish line, at which point they got a standing ovation. So I told that story, and the next day, yesterday, this man came who had struggled very difficult on the retreat. And he's a lawyer, and he's not very happy with his work and his job, and he feels that you know, he's constantly trying to win and compete and make more money and get ahead. And he heard that story, and it moved him deeply, and it made him kind of wonder, what am I doing with my life? Is this really the perspective? Is this really the values that I want to get behind? The values of competition, the values of success in a materialistic way, and success in status, and or do I want to, there are other values, values of community, of friendship, of togetherness, which are more important. Perspectives. So, and I told another story, which I learned recently. I think a very nice story, I thought, a kind of an analogy of much of human life, perhaps. There's these tourists on a tourist bus, a tour bus, and they're going through the most beautiful countryside in the world, just incredible scenery. But they're driving this bus, and all the curtains are pulled down in the bus, so they can't see out. And they're completely preoccupied about who on the bus gets to take the seat of honor, and who's taking, you know, the wrong seat, and how to get up to the front seat, and how to negotiate their way. And does that sound familiar? You know, you're kind of missing the point, right, of being on a tour bus, and where you're sitting. You lift the curtain and look out the window and see what's really going on here. Enjoy yourself. Look and see the scenery. See your friends and your family. Get to know them. And there are many ways in which our perspective, our priorities in life, get reoriented. And many of us know some of the powerful ways that can happen. I mean, one of them is death. The encounter with death, whether a close encounter of ourselves or someone that we love has died, can be extremely powerful. Cause for reflection about what's really important in our lives. I did a retreat some years ago in Los Angeles on death and dying. I did a particular guided meditation on death, where some of you did it here in Palo Alto. I think it was last year we did it. The one on, if you only have 10 hours left to live, what would you do with those last 10 hours? And then you reflect on that for a while. And then you reflect, now if you only had an hour left to live, what would you do with that hour? And if you only had 10 minutes left to live, what would you do with those 10 minutes? And then if you only had a minute left, what would that last minute be like? What would you do? And what if death was now? What would that be like? So I did that progression. And I got a phone call a few weeks later from this woman who was there. And she was a high-powered executive for a major kind of non-profit corporation in Los Angeles. And she called me to say that she'd resigned from her job because of that meditation. So, well, you know, what have I done? But the encounter with death, you know, and what's important. And she, it's about 2 years now, I guess, since then, and she's been extremely happy with her life and the changes she's made. Someone sent us this, my wife and I, this Christmas card this year that had this wonderful quote by Diane Ackerman. When you consider something like death, it probably doesn't matter if we try too hard, are awkward sometimes, care for one another too deeply, are excessively curious about nature, are too open to experience, enjoy non-stop expense of the senses in an effort to know life intimately and lovingly. It probably doesn't matter if, while trying to be modest and eager watchers of life's many spectacles, we sometimes look clumsy or get dirty or ask stupid questions or reveal our ignorance or say something wrong or light up with wonder like children we are. It probably doesn't matter if a passerby sees us dipping a finger into the moist pouches of dozens of lady slippers to find out what bugs tend to fall into them and think us a bit eccentric. Or a neighbor fetching her mail sees us standing in the cold with our own letters in one hand and a seismically red autumn leaf in the other, its color hitting our senses like a blow from a stun gun as we stand with a huge grin, too paralyzed by the intricately vein gaudiness of the leaf to move. Probably doesn't matter. And we all know, you know, aging is a powerful reorienting of our priorities and perspectives. And thank God for many of us, right? I remembered recently when I was about 13 or so, 12 or 13, long hair was kind of a thing. So I was, you know, I had long hair, kind of beetle, mop, you know, whatever it was called. And it might not actually be any longer than it is now, but for that time, that was quite something. And I was living in Italy. And in Italy, in this little town in Italy, I was like the coolest dude in town. You know, I was the longest hair, and I was the only one who had blue jeans. It was like blue jeans were just happening in Italy, and I thought I was pretty hot, and I would kind of strut around town, you know, hot 13-year-old, long hair, and super cool. And then we moved back to America, to Los Angeles, and my hair was not very long anymore, and blue jeans were not necessarily, you know, so novel anymore. And my hair wasn't long enough, and I felt terrible about myself, and felt inadequate, and felt, you know, humbled, and, you know, and I would sit in class kind of pulling my hair. And my hair, you know, wasn't any different, really, from Italy and Los Angeles. So somehow my priorities or my values, you know, hopefully I don't have those kind of values anymore. My zits don't care, matter so much as they did back when I was 14. Things change, our identity, what's important changes. Going off into nature and spending, you know, a week or 10 days just out in the mountains in the high country, the things that seem so mortifying or so important to tend to here simply lose their importance. And you wonder why you're so preoccupied by them up, you know, after spending 5-6 days in the high country by yourself. You know, you spill ketchup on your white shirt at work, and it's, you know, a serious event. And, you know, and you're very worried. You spill ketchup on your shirt at the High Sierras and you know, hardly notice. I don't know if that's a good analogy, but there's things that we get very caught up in our normal life, I think, in another environment, we wonder why was that so important for us? And part of the reason is that we internalize society's values. A lot of the priorities that we live our lives by are really internalized values from our society. And our society doesn't necessarily have our best interests in mind. Oh, so at this retreat, I started to say, if I may, at this retreat, one of the things that was moving about this retreat, it was a Catholic retreat center, and was built to be a retreat center for Catholic contemplatives, kind of, and it felt like a very, very, like it was like kind of like a little bit like a Zen center, modern Zen center, since they really took care of it really well. You could feel the contemplative care that had gone into there. I've been to Catholic institutions, little centers, monasteries before that didn't have this kind of contemplative feel. And they let us use their chapel. And they had, you know, the Christ on the wall. And we had our Buddha statue on our altar. And they had their Mother Mary painting on the wall. And we had our Kuan Yin behind the Buddha. And it just all felt, you know, like they were very welcoming, and there were some brothers there, and they were so welcoming, and they're so happy we were there, and were delighted in us. And one of the monks lent me this book called The Way to Love by Anthony de Mello, a Catholic monk. He said, oh, you like this book. What do you think of it? It's just like what you teach. And it's better than what I teach. But it seems just like, you know, it felt like, you know, pure Buddhism or pure universal wisdom kind of thing. It didn't matter what tradition it belonged to, just like great wisdom. And then on Friday night, the cooks made challah. And so the manager went to the cooks and asked if they would do the Shabbat blessing. So all the retreatants gathered in the dining room and kind of held hands, and we lit the candle, did the whole Jewish kind of ceremony of, you know. And then, but the cooks themselves, they were Hindus. You know, on this bhakti path. And they were like into devotion and part of, and being of service. And they were doing this tremendously fantastic food. I've never eaten so well in my life as in this retreat center. But these people are just throwing their devotion into the food. And it just felt like this great party, you know. Catholicism and Buddhism and Hinduism and Judaism. And we just, you know, it didn't matter. It was just like all this... you know, what's really important in our religious life, and what are the divisions? What are the importance of, you know, do we hold hands as we walk toward the finish line, or do we race to see which religion can get there first? So he gave me this book, and the opening chapter starts. Recall the feeling you have when someone praises you. when you are approved, applauded. And contrast that with the kind of feeling that arises when you look at the sunset or the sunrise or nature in general, or when you read a book or watch a movie that you thoroughly enjoy. Get a taste of this feeling and contrast it with the first, namely the one that was generated within you when you were praised. Understand that the first type of feeling comes from self-glorification, self-promotion. It is a worldly feeling. The second comes from self-fulfillment, a soul feeling. Here is another contrast. Recall the kind of feeling you have when you succeed, when you get to the top, when you win a game or a bet or an argument, and contrast it with the kind of feeling you get when you really enjoy the job you're doing. You are absorbed in it, the action that you are currently engaged in. And once again, notice the qualitative difference between the worldly feeling and the soul feeling. And yet another contrast. Remember what you felt like when you had power, when you were the boss. People looked up to you, took orders from you, or when you were popular. And contrast that with worldly feeling, contrast that worldly feeling with the feeling of intimacy, companionship. The times you thoroughly enjoyed yourself in the company of a friend or with a group in which there was fun and laughter. Having done this, attempt to understand the true nature of worldly feelings, namely the feeling of self-promotion, self-glorification. They are not natural. They were invented by our society and our culture to make you productive and to make you controllable. These feelings do not produce the nourishment and happiness that is produced when one contemplates nature or enjoys the company of one's friends or one's work. They were meant to produce thrills, excitement, and emptiness. So he contrasts, you know, two ways of being. Kind of one is self-promotion, and the other is self-fulfillment. It's interesting to watch our emotional life and see, is our emotions arising out of the feelings of self-promotion and the opposite of that, which is closely tied to it, or does it arise out of a sense of self-fulfillment, or maybe we don't even need the word self, out of fulfillment. And you get qualitative, very different emotions arise out of the two. Very different kinds of joy arise out of the two kinds of ways. So what are the priorities we have? So retreat is a powerful place to look at our priorities and reorient our priorities. There's a kind of intimacy we find in ourselves, a kind of care we find what's really important for us, a possibility we find in engaging ourselves with our pain. So much pain in our society. So much pain. When Ajahn Sumedho was teaching in the West for a while, he had taught and practiced and taught in Thailand first for many years. He was asked, what was the difference between teaching in the West and teaching in Asia to Asians? And he said, oh, self-hatred. There's so much self-hatred in the West and so much pain. And he didn't see that in Thailand. So to open it, you know, the gift is wrapped in the pain. So to see the possibility of that, of the possibility of opening more deeply to our life, more deeply to love. DiMello, in this book, he says, he defines love as seeing clearly, which is the definition of mindfulness. Oh, it's in this chapter called Be Awake. Everywhere in the world, people are in search of love. For everyone is convinced that love alone can save the world. Love alone can make life meaningful and worth living. But how very few understand what love really is and how it arises in the human heart. It is so frequently equated with good feelings towards others, with benevolence or nonviolence or service. But these things in themselves are not love. Love springs from awareness. It is only in as much as you see someone as he or she really is, here and now, and not as they are in your memory or your desire or your imagination or projection, that you can truly love them. Otherwise, it is not the person that you love, but the idea that you have formed of this person, or this person as the object of your desire, not he or she as in themselves. Therefore, the first act of love is to see this person or this object, this reality, as it truly is. And this involves an enormous discipline of dropping your desires, your prejudices, your memories, your projections, your selective way of looking. A discipline so great that most people would rather plunge headlong into good actions and service than submit to the burning fire of this practice. When you set out to serve someone whom you have not taken the trouble to see, are you meeting that person's need or your own? So the first ingredient of love is to really see the other. The second ingredient is equally important, to see yourself, to ruthlessly flash the light of awareness on your motives, your emotions, your needs, your dishonesty, your self-seeking, your tendencies to control and manipulate. This means calling things by their name, no matter how painful the discovery and the consequences. If you achieve this kind of awareness of other and yourself, you will know what love is. So define love. So what happens from a long retreat often is not necessarily, what's of consequence is not necessarily the state that we attain during the retreat. States of being come and go. Our calm or the strength of our mindfulness, our concentration. But what's important is really a new perspective or a new orientation, alignment with the perspective that's been lost, or a kind of a resorting out of what our priorities really are. And I know it's, from my own experience, it's very, very easy to lose track of our important priorities, what's important for us, and to be caught up in ones that don't seem so important or are petty or have to do with more with self-promotion than fulfillment with real love. And a retreat is a time, in a sense, where even without thinking about it as a real central issue of the retreat, there's kind of a natural way in which people will use the retreat to look at their life in a new way and come to new conclusions about what's really important. And then what happens after a few weeks is we forget that. So one of the things that's very, very important to do, I feel, in spiritual practice, is find some way to regularly and in a deep way be reminded about what your real priorities are in your life, and not to be caught up in all the kind of petty concerns and petty involvements or just all the little details of life that we all have to take care of. And in the taking care of all the details, lose track of what's really important in our heart, what really is our priority. And if we can water the seeds of our priorities, if we can water the seeds of our best intentions, they'll grow. They'll grow and they'll blossom in beautiful ways in our life. But you won't necessarily see how that's happening in the moment. We don't necessarily see how consequence works. But things, intentions have great consequence. So what do you think? It's your turn. Yes?
Apropos of love and awareness, I think awareness and attention are so important that they are love.
That's what he says. And one place you see it is, maybe kind of more clearly than usual, is with children. Children have a tremendous need to be seen. And it's the same thing as being loved. But do you want to say more about it?
Well, I know that children won't thrive if they don't have attention. You don't necessarily have to consciously give them love at all. Just attention. Be aware of them. And in fact, criminals have been known to kill to get attention.
Yes.
To have their names on the page of the newspaper so that they know that they exist.
Or misplaced attempts to try to get love. And then you could turn it around also in a sense. I think one of the most profound forms of self-love, loving oneself, is to really see oneself, to turn the light of awareness back and really get to know oneself as one is. And that's what he says. And He says, in order to love, you have to really understand yourself also. Yeah.
I was having a hard time with that passage about the difference between being praised and just doing the job, and that one is sort of great and terrific, and the other one's a little questionable. And I thought, but maybe really the praise is, maybe the point isn't praise, oh, you're terrific, you're wonderful, but it's really being acknowledged or just simply being seen. I mean, just sometimes to just do a job all by yourself, if nobody's aware of it, you kind of wonder, well, why am I doing this?
Yes.
I mean, it's kind of, that seems sort of isolated.
Yeah, but maybe I should have said it as before, after I read it. I read some of these things that he mentioned in context. Praise can be both wonderful and healthy and wholesome, and our reaction to praise. And praise can be kind of, you know, someone's kissing up to us, and also our reaction to praise can be kind of feeling of gratitude and appreciation that someone appreciates us. Or it can be, we can get all puffed up. And I took, you know, DeMello's quotation to mean the second type, the kind of being puffed up. And because he was making the contrast, I gave him the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
Yes?
I think your talk is really timely for me today because I've been struggling a lot since Saturday or Friday since I heard about the man who was killed.
Oh, I didn't know. I've been gone.
And I had a lot of trouble finding meaning or understanding in it all. And to what the gentleman was saying about how children need attention, they just want attention, and it starts from early on. And that I can make a difference in people's lives that way. So thank you.
Yes. Early on, it reminds me of Thich Nhat Hanh, who spent so much of the 80s trying to help the Vietnamese boat people as they fled Vietnam, and he was so painfully aware of the boat pirates who would do terrible things to the Vietnamese when they were at high sea, he would say that if he had grown up as a poor Thai fisherman, some of the coastal areas of Thailand, in the kind of situation that poverty and difficulty and stuff, he also probably would have ended up as a sea pirate. And the conditions in which we grow up in, the way in which we receive, are so important in the formation of who we are. I thought that was a very powerful statement of him to say that. And I think it's true. You know, we're not so different from each other. And so we want to be very careful I'm sorry, I'm tired, so maybe excuse me for going on. So I gave this talk on priorities and intentions and perspectives Saturday night, a talk, not this one. And then next morning, the teacher I was teaching with, Eric Kolvig, picked up the theme. And he said, once you recognize what your intentions are, what's very useful to do is to reflect on two things. And one is what you need to receive in order to support that intention. What you need to receive, what kind of conditions you need to set up. If, you know, friendships, maybe having a sitting group, maybe, you know, a little bit of peace and quiet, maybe, you know, maybe some support from friends or whatever. What do you need to receive in order to kind of be able to, because it's very hard alone to follow through on our intentions. And then he said, the other thing to ask is what can you give? What can you give others? And not just simply stop, you know, what can I receive in order to support me, but what can I also give to support others? What can I give to that supports other people and their intentions and desire and priorities? Yes?
I went to one of the Sati classes, and this was the one taught by Don Rand on Buddhist ethics. And it met on a Saturday, two Saturdays, 2 weeks apart. And the assignment between the classes was to take one of the precepts and in the morning make an intention about it, whatever came up. And that was a very helpful and instructive thing for me. And then in the evening to kind of review it.
Uh-huh.
And it was helpful to have that supportive context around, you know, doing
that. To know that you in 2 weeks you were going
right.
to... Would it be okay to ask you to give an example of...
Yeah, one of the things that surprised me the most was I took the first precept, not to kill, and I wasn't really thinking specifically about where I was going, walking or whatever, but I began to notice one day that I looked at the ground just as I was about to step on something. And that's a very small example, but the important thing for me was how, with that intention, other things around the intention come up and make me more aware, even though it's not something I'm specifically focusing on.
Yes.
It really struck me very forcefully.
This is a very, very good example of the way in which intentions will flower or surface in unexpected times. You set an intention, you kind of water a little bit, then you don't know when, but at some point it becomes significant, and suddenly, oh, you know, this, it comes back again and informs you or opens up the world in a new way. Yes?
I was just thinking about how long intentions last. It seems that they fade, some of their energy or whatever, it seems to fade over time. Seems like there's a need for a renewal of those intentions,
right.
Whatever they may be.
So that's a good, insight. So she said, if I can remember, that it seems that intentions, she was wondering how long intentions lasted. And some intentions seem to, or it seems like intentions kind of fade over time and they need to periodically be renewed. And I thought that was a very nice insight because that's true. And so what is it that renews our intentions? And one of them is there's kind of a natural renewal that happens. If we're very sensitive, very open and sensitive to what's going on in the present moment, I think it's almost natural, for example, to want to live by the precepts. So the simplicity of being can come from spiritual development. And kind of a natural, and even without thinking of it, intention kind of surfaces. But also, when it's more intentional, more intentions, it has to, finding ways to renew it periodically. And so I'll give you an example, but in a moment, what I've been doing. But she said, you know, that intentions, how long do they last, intentions? Intentions can last very short. They can just last a few seconds, maybe. Or they can have this subterranean life where they kind of last for a while and then surface in other ways. This has to do with the Buddhist idea of karma I'm thinking about. The consequences of intentions. The consequences of an intention can last for lifetimes, Buddhists say. The intention might only last a few seconds. And this is kind of the subterranean kind of way in which our intentionality within us manifests itself in unusual times and unusual ways long after the intention was initially started. But anyway, one thing that I've been doing, ever since Lou Richman gave a talk here, about a month ago, I think he talked about intentions, and I was inspired. And since then, what I've been doing is in the morning, I look at my schedule book for the day and things I had written down I had to do. And I'd sit there for a moment, and I would look at each thing, each item, and I reflect on what my intention was around that activity. And, you know, there was this, you know, the obvious intention was, go shopping. Well, get food. But you know, what was the intention that I really? What was the, in my list of my priorities? What was the real intention that I had for my life when I go shopping? Because the food is kind of not so consequential. So maybe it was, can I maybe be friendly with someone in the store? Can I be friendly with a clerk, perhaps? That to me maybe more important than getting the food and getting out of there as quickly as I can. Or if I'm going to meet someone. Can I extend my friendship? Or can I help that person become more at ease in their life? Or can I love that person? Or if I'm doing some activity by myself, can I use this activity as a way to become freer, to become more awake, to be more present? And I'll kind of go through a list and kind of see what kind of intention like that I might have with it. And I find all this joy to doing that. It's been delightful to do it. So much joy that I would sit down and I would start putting all kinds of things I was going to do during the day. Not just simply the major things you usually put down. I would just have, so my list would be really long because I just love to sit there and just kind of write it down and think about it. And I think that it has a great effect. We'll see. I mean, I've only been doing it for a few weeks. It's too soon to report. But I've been really enjoying it. And I suspect that it has major... it's a major kind of conditioner for renewing intentions and it kind of, you know, if you take a time to think about what you really want to do in a situation, when you end up going to do the situation, maybe you're a little bit more liable to act on that intention than you were otherwise. A little bit more likely, slightly more likely to try to be kind or friendly to the store clerk rather than, you know, trying to get out of there as quickly as you can. Yes?
After Lou Richmond's talk, I happened to catch a rebroadcast of an interview with Phil Jackson, the coach of the Chicago Bears, talking about...
Bulls. This is very important. This is very important. Oh, yes. Oh, so Lou Richmond, for those of you who weren't here that day, I think it was Memorial Day.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people weren't here. He's a Zen priest who was a kind of Zen teacher for many years, who then left the Zen world and became a businessman. Worked for Smith & Hawkins, was an executive for a while, then started his own software company. And is very interested in bringing practice to daily life and to work, and specifically to work. And so afterwards we went out and talked for a while after the, and he'd be interested in coming back here and doing a workshop for us on the topic. And I was going to ask, I forgot to ask afterwards, how many of you are interested in such a thing?
Make it a fundraiser.
He's clear about his...
Yeah, his intentions are clear. Well, that's quite gratifying to hear so many of you want. I think what he had in mind was to do it something like four weekday evenings, like in a row, I think. Is that workable for enough people?
No.
You probably prefer to do like a Saturday? Yeah, four. I mean, that's what I meant. I said wrong. Four Tuesdays.
Not Monday, Thursday.
No, Monday, Thursday. Four Tuesdays or something. So I'm going to talk to him in the next few weeks. I'll mention the enthusiasm. What we talked about was that, because I was, you're not going to like this. It was next spring.
Oh.
What's the rush? So I'll tell him. Maybe we can do it in the fall. I'll tell him. I'll talk to him about it. The other thing is, it slipped my mind. Oh yes, Phil Jackson. On the airport, San Francisco Airport, on the way to Santa Fe, I was looking for a book to read, and I came across this book called Sacred Hoops, which is what?
That is what that interview was about.
I see. And Sacred Hoops is about Phil Jackson. He's the coach of the Chicago Bulls, who those of you who don't follow sports, or those of you who are don't follow sports. I don't follow sports, but this is such a major thing, you know, Phil Jackson. It's like he's a superstar, and he's not even a player. He's the coach, but he's a Zen student. And he's coached the five-time all-time American basketball championship team, teaching them some of the things that he learned from his spiritual practice and some of it from his Zen practice. And he talks a little bit about Zen, but he talks a lot about mindfulness. And he talks a lot about working as a team, and which was a hard thing for the basketball players to learn because they're all in it for their you know, to be the greatest superstar each individually. And I was kind of inspired by the book. It's kind of easy to read, and it's an example of the application of some of the spiritual values that we have into a place like sports. When I was in 20 years ago in college, a sports coach told me that the way that Eastern religion, Eastern wisdom was going to enter into America was through sports. Maybe it is. Maybe we're doing it wrong.
My coworker told me a story this afternoon sitting for intention and awareness that she was talking to her friend, the airline stewardess, and frequently flies with this pilot that's very sympathetic to the animals and the cargo. And they had a changeover and they were moving the cargo and this man's dog was dead. And they didn't know how it had happened. So they went out and they bought another dog. And put the dog's tag on it. And then presented it to the child. And he goes, "That is not my dog." Well, let's look at the tags here. Well, I'm telling you, this is not my dog. My dog was dead. I was taking it.
That's a good one. So at the end of many practice events, we dedicate the merit. So may whatever merit our intention has had of our practicing together today in this little 40-minute sitting and 40-minute discussion and talk, may that intention be for the benefit of all beings, so that all beings, all our friends and family and neighbors, so all of them can be touched in visible and invisible ways by our intentions to be kind, to be open, to be present, to see clearly, and to love each other. May all beings be happy. And if you want tickets to Sharon's talk, you can...